Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting on the road. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be talking about a nutrient that improves the neuron insulin signaling. That means, in lay language, your brain mitochondria is going to improve. More energy in the brain, meaning less brain fatigue, less brain fog, less lack of clarity, and greater cognitive functioning. And this is from Zhenjin Chao University in China. Then we're going to look at how could eating honey be a form of microbe time travel. Interesting discussion. We're also going to look at the newest information on lavender oil. I gave you a lot the other day. I'm going to give you more today. Plus, from Case Western University, how calcium and magnesium decreases the risk of metabolic syndrome, like diabetes. And also from Sitel Baylor University in Turkey, a study strengthens the olive leaf extract's ability to help your heart. So we have a lot to share, all good. Then we're going to look at some environmental issues. I'm going to address what most people watching the debate missed when it came to one specific comment by Hillary Clinton blaming Bernie Sanders, for he was the only one on the panel who voted to deregulate Wall Street. Well, that's not true, and I'll give you the explanation why. This is just typical of the kind of spin that they engage in. My guest in the second part of our program is Mike Lofgren. We're going to talk about the rise of a shadow government in Washington. Who is he? He was in Washington working on Capitol Hill till just a few years ago for 29 years, and he worked in the House and Senate on budget committees, military spending. He knows where all the bodies are buried. He has seen and been a part of those debacles. And while he's here, I'm going to lead off with how the U.S. government has long used propaganda against the American people, with very specific examples, quotes from congressional testimony. It's not specious, it's not speculative, it's historical fact. Also, if time permits, I'm not sure it will. If not, we'll do it another day. I want to give you one more piece of the puzzle. I'll be doing this on a weekly basis, of why the worldwide economy is imploding, not all at once, but segments. You have to look at the segments. If I have a tree and it's really green and beautiful on the top, but if I'm beginning to see specks on leaves, I don't wait till the whole tree is barren and then say, what's wrong? I immediately analyze the defect and see if I can stop, whether it's a fungus or an infestation, early on. I want to show you early on why the European Union is collapsing. Now, you won't see it collapse, but it's like a person that's having a heart attack a minute before. They look fine, and then they had their heart attack. America is having millions of heart attacks, as is the European Union and other countries. I'll give you specifics on that. Let's begin. There is a flavonone, and it is called naringin, N-A-R-I-N-G-I-N. According to an important study done in China, quote, the epidemic and experimental studies have confirmed that the obesity induced by a high-fat diet not only caused neural insulin resistance, but also induced brain mitochondrial dysfunction as well as learning impairment. Naringin, a flavonone, has been reported to possess biological functions which are beneficial to human cognition, but is also a protective effect of the HFD-induced cognitive defects and underlying mechanisms have not been characterized, end quote. In lay language, it means that when you're on a fatty diet, and the vast majority of Americans are, if you're eating the standard American diet, pizzas, fat, hot dogs, hamburgers, luncheon meats, fat, milkshakes, cheeses, dairy, fat, fried foods like French fries, very serious because the part of what they do, they grow a particular type of potato, and then it's treated in such a way that it absorbs a certain amount of the fat, which gives it part of its flavor, and then they enhance that with salt, and people are not aware how much sodium and trans fats they're consuming. All of that is destructive to your biochemistry. None of it is healthy. You could say that the average American doesn't eat a single healthy thing sometimes for days on end. They may occasionally have an orange or an apple, but that's an aside. The vast majority of what we consume are the meat-based, deep-fried, carbohydrate-rich foods. That causes inflammation. That, in turn, causes inflammation not just around your joints, but in your brain. Alzheimer's, inflammatory. Multiple sclerosis, ALS, inflammatory. Huntington's disease, inflammatory. Parkinson's, inflammatory. So, as we age, the more inflammation that we have had in our system, the quicker the process manifests. So if you've eaten a healthy diet, if you've been conscious of the choices, if you've been hyper-conscious, like starting your day with some lemon juice or apple cider vinegar, that really alkalizes the body and helps turn off pain and inflammation. If you've taken the right nutrients, if you've eaten the right fruits and vegetables on a consistent basis, then you may be 50, but your brain is probably 30. Whereas if you've eaten the average diet, binge drank in college, drank socially afterwards, you're 50, but your brain is more likely 100. And hence, by the time you're 65 to 70, you're forgetting, you're in losing cognition, memory, and then you're into the initial stages of Alzheimer's or dementia. So by taking in the flavonone, let me give it to you again, Narin, N-A-R-I-N, Gin, G-I-N, Narigen, then you're able to block that, protect it. And it's very important, so it could help you. And almost everyone who's overweight, you definitely should be consuming it. It's very simple. My suggestion is, in order to protect your hippocampus, which is important in all of this, just get the supplements, go to your local health food store. It's inexpensive, easy to obtain, and you're not going to be able to get enough from fruits, but where you'd primarily get it. Now, on the cellular level, this might be hard to visualize, but there are billions of years of biological information encoded within your cells. And that, depending upon what you do or don't do, what you eat or don't eat, what you drink or don't drink, will either activate or allow to remain latent many parts of the DNA. According to GreenMedInfo, it's a biological fact that the distant past is embedded within the present. And we have not been able to appreciate this. In fact, every cell in your body, along with all the cells and all living creatures on the planet, derive from the last universal common ancestor. That's called Luca. It established and is estimated to have lived some 3.5 to 3.8 billion years ago in the primordial ocean. And while this may strike the listener as an unusual concept, even Charles Darwin acknowledged this phenomenon, Origins of the Species. By the way, he wrote that back in 1859. He said, "Therefore, I should infer from analogy that probably all the organic beings which have ever lived on this earth have descended from some one mortal form into which life was first breathed. Well, the germ-like cells within our bodies, do you know which cells are germ-like? Ovum and sperm. They represent a quasi-immortal and unbroken biological thread tying us all back through an almost infinite number of cell replications to what I said earlier, the last universal common ancestor. Now, these germ-like cells represent, against all odds, the resilience of biological systems that persist through incalculable vast stretches of time and innumerable vectors of adversity. They are deathless. They cannot die. Relative to somatic cells, in that their biological information has been passed down from generation to generation for billions of years without interruption, and that will continue to be passed forward within the successfully conceived progeny of all the species inhabiting this planet today. And so biological entities are unique insofar as they inhabit the present while containing within themselves information stretching so far back in the distant past as to approach geologic time scales. Now, let me make this just a little simpler. Before we delve into nutrition as a form of the microbiological time travel, we first have to provide a context by taking a brief look at how our species' self-definition has been completely transformed by the discovery that we are at least as much germs as we are humans. Now, some people say, well, that's just stupid, Gary. Of course we are not germs. Really? Are you aware that you have 10 times more bacteria, germs, in your body than you do cells, and that these germs communicate with each other, and that there is always an effort for homeostasis balance, that when you consume sugar or alcohol or fried food, you are feeding the bad germs, which then proliferate, and you end up manifesting distension, yeast infections, weakened immune system, suppressing up to 50% of your immune system with 100 grams of that sugar for up to 6 hours, which makes you more susceptible if you have a cold or flu. Or if you have one, you're more likely to have a downturn. And if you don't have one, you're more likely to get sick. So germs do count. We now know that we are more microbial than human. What do I mean? Constituted by at least 10 times more bacterial, viral, and fungal cells than actual human cells, we are more accurately described, at least perhaps even more profound is the fact that the total genetic information in our bodies is about 99% microbial in origin, with many of these microbes performing life-sustaining functions for digestion, immunity, even cognition. Even when explore only the private genetic contribution of our cells, we find that the human genome is about 10% viral, which is retroviral in origin, and our mitochondria are actually alien in origin. Somewhere about 1.5 billion years ago, an ancient bacteria entered into the symbiotic relationship with our cells to perform both oxygen-destroying and energy-producing functions by losing their independence and becoming our mitochondria. Now, when we look at ourselves through this microbial lens, where we end and the living and breathing environment begins is no longer as clear as the boundary of our skin. What we eat or expose ourselves to chemically, for instance. Because what do you think you're eating? Just think for a moment. Just stop for a moment. Just put it down. What you're eating cannot be used until it is biochemically completely restructured. You can take a vitamin B6 paradoxing pill, but the body can't use it. It has to break it down. What breaks it down? It's broken down in the liver to pyridoxal 5-phosphate. How does that happen? Through different bioenergetics. How does it know to do that? It has memory. Where did that memory come from? It was always there. That's your biological consistency. You blink your eyes. You didn't tell yourself, I better blink my eyes every 8 seconds or I'll go blind from not having enough tear to keep my eye lens lubricated. Well, I better start my digestive process. Well, wait, today I ate brown rice, and that's digested differently than if I ate bean sprouts. Did you figure out how to digest your food? How does it know to do it? Did you tell your heart to beat sitting down at one rate, standing up at another, walking at another, jogging at another, racing at another, under stress, flight or fright, hormones, another, and then come right back to normal? No, you didn't. No human being that has ever lived has understood life. We cannot replicate it without energy. Energy is the source of all being. But energy can only function as we know it if it's allowed to manifest at a higher level of energy, health, happiness, spiritual attainment, or at a lower level of energy. Confusion, anxiety, fear, rage, anger, jealousy. How dare you have more than me? But behind all that, there's cells. And those cells will either produce disease or those cells will produce death. And you won't have a chance to manifest the health that you once took for granted. So we should be humble enough, austere and conscious enough to appreciate that we are microbiological entities manifesting in the hologenome theory of evolution that states that we are a holobiont, a host whose fate is and always was inseparable bound to all of its symbiotic microbes. As with classical evolutionary theory on how genes evolve, selective pressures from the environment have shaped the types and numbers of microbes that now form the basis for both our health and disease susceptibility. I had this discussion this morning saying, do you really feel that by suffering that you're a better person? Do you intentionally put yourself into a position to be martyred by helping people who will never appreciate your help? And then you feel somehow you're obligated to stay attached to their energy rather than evolving to help those people who do appreciate your help and will help themselves and others, passing it along. And that's our conditioned self. But that's an intellectual and familial and religious and cultural conditioning. So we think we're independent. I'm my own person. You think? You really think you are? Challenge it. And see, can you live beyond your feelings if your feelings are completely conditional? And about 97% of everything we feel comes through predetermined condition response. When Hippocrates said, we are what we eat, this was true, not only in molecular terms, meaning the food we eat produces molecular building blocks from which our bodies are constructed, but also in microbial terms, meaning the microbes we expose ourselves to and cultivate through nutrition affects and permanently alter our holobiont cells, which leads us to the topic I mentioned at the beginning of the program and this discussion, honey. Honey as a microbiological time travel. While we often think of our caveman ancestors as being shaped primarily by their meat-based diet and the harnessing of fire for cooking and acquiring and eating honey may have been an equally crucial dietary determinant in our evolutionary trajectory as well. According to one researcher, Dr. Crittenden, honey helped make us human. Let me quote this. I found this interesting. It appears that the human sweet tooth has a long history in human evolution. New research proposes that honey may have been important to human evolution. Upper Paleolithic meaning that would be, what, about 8,000 to 40,000 years ago, rock art from all around the world depicts images of early humans collecting honey. The images range from figures climbing ladders to access hives, to residing high in trees, to figures smoking out hives filled with honeycomb. Honey and bee larvae are important foods consumed by many populations of hunters and gatherers worldwide. Foragers in Latin America, Asia, Australia, and Africa include honey and bee larvae as major components of their diet. The Hadza hunter-gatherers of Tanzania, the population with whom I work, even list honey as their number one preferred food item, end quote. So let's examine this just for a moment. And I'm putting this out here just as a theoretical discussion, so you can accept or reject it, but at least think about it. Honey actually contains a range of beneficial microbes contributed by bees in the plants they forage, including lactic acid-producing bacteria, that's the lactobacilli. And when eaten raw, and that's the only way I suggest anybody ever eat honey, raw, unfiltered. I'm a beekeeper, so this is something I'm acutely familiar with. I've raised bees for 40 years. And never using their honey for myself, I always give the honey back because that's their food. What you want the bee for is you want them to pollinate. And then also they can produce some pollen or they can produce some bee propolis, which in ancient times you would put into a wound and it could help save a leg. Oh, by the way, later today I will put some photographs for you to see of a foot that was going to be amputated and within 3 months was completely healed. You'll see each stage of that healing. You can see right into the bone and you can see the flesh, you can see everything. And medicine, the person was actually in hospice care and medicine had nothing more it could do except start amputating. The person didn't lose anything and has a completely normal, healthy foot and is completely normal and healthy today. I'm putting it up today for you to watch. In any case, bee propolis could have helped that person. Bee propolis is what helped many of the soldiers not die from septicemia during the Civil War because they packed bee propolis and honey into the wounds, at least those who knew about it, mainly country boys. Well, these bacteria, which are so important to health-promoting strains to our bodies, have been identified as indispensable to the immunity of the individuals in the hive as a whole, as well as in affecting the behavior of the different types of bees that inhabit these complex colonies. And considering the possibility of our ancient co-evolutionary relationship with honey, is it possible that our own immune systems and the microbial populations share dependency on honey-based microbes? Just a question. It's a hypothesis. It's not an absolute statement. Now, there's no doubt that in a day and age where the previously timeless and unbroken chain of microbial custody between vaginally birthed and exclusively breastfed offspring has been profoundly disrupted by cesareans and artificial milk substitutes and vaccinations, our inner microbial terrain has been completely ravaged. Add to this the daily barrage of food likes, but synthetic dietary inputs, along with a battery of microbiological toxicants unleashed by the Industrial Revolution and now festering in the post-industrial chemical soup that we are now all swimming in. The intimate link between the human and microbial side of the holobionts, multi-dimensional identity has all but become irreparably severed. Could honey help heal these wounds? Could eating ancestral foods infused with equally ancient symbiotic bacteria help us recover and, in effect, at the microbiological level, travel back in biological time to a far more stable health? Could these bacteria and their metabolic byproducts provide epigenetically meaningful information to regulate the expression of our own genome? Could this also explain why honey has been identified to have at least 100 health benefits? Now, there was a fascinating study published in PLOS in 2012 that might help answer the question. It's entitled Symbiotins as Major Modulators of Insect Health, Lactic Acid Bacteria and Honeybees. That's the title of the article. It's characterized the diverse and ancient lactic acid bacteria populations of microbiota within the honey crop of honeybees and related species. And amazingly, they discovered species from the lactobacillus and the bifobacterium genera, and these are probiotics, in these bees that suggest an 80 million year or older history of association. Lay language, what does that mean? It means that honeybees and their honey may contain bacteria that humans may have maintained contact with and ingested throughout the entire course of their evolution as foragers of honey, which would also include our pre-human predecessors. So within the confines of their bodies, these insects may have provided an environment for these ancient symbiotic bacteria to survive intact for millions of years, enabling animals and, like humans, to periodically replenish their microbiomes through consuming bee products like honey infused with them. And since food is not just fuel or building blocks, like amino acids or carbohydrates broken down, the polysaccharides, but informational, containing epigenetic inheritance systems, is real and valid to the expression of our DNA as the primary nucleotide sequences in our genome. This discovery, I believe, has profound implications for those whose microbial heritage has been decimated and supplanted with genetically altered, like chemically induced foods, and instead of eating real, wholesome, clean foods and wild harvested raw honey, we're eating just the opposite. And by the way, nature never provides us with a half answer. We just have to look for the other part. You couldn't have this apply to honey and not have it apply to other things as well. These trajectories throughout history are there, and all we have to do is pay attention to them. The enzymes and the antimicrobial factors that our genome itself does not possess. This is why seeming superstitious farming practices such as taking wild soil from old-growth systems and using it to inoculate in newer farming land. How brilliant was that they did that? Because it effectively allowed them to produce vitally nourishing food instead of on denatured soil. These old-growth microbial communities, perhaps a byproduct of millions of years of coevolution, are capable of contributing a wide range of biotransformed soil metabolites for the plant's nutritional needs. Something to think about, just an idea. Now ask yourself this as my final thought on this. Just imagine you go into nature, you go around trees and meadows, and you're walking in the spring and summer through wildflowers, and you see the honeybee, you see the butterfly, you feel nature vibrating in sync with you. You're eating berries, wild berries. When I was in Sweden, the Ralph Nader of Sweden invited me to go and see these wild berries. Think of, and they're tiny little things, but very sweet because they have very short seasons, so they adapted to that. More intensity in the growing cycle, because it's so short, it compensated. But just imagine how you feel when you're by the water, a lake, a stream, a tributary, a river, an ocean. Think how you feel when you're sitting under a weeping willow tree or you're smelling jasmine at night. There is a reason why we do better in nature when we're eating wholesome foods, when we're around the creatures of life that we learn to co-evolve with. And there's a big difference between that and living an artificial existence in cities or suburbs, disconnecting ourselves epigenetically and becoming stressed and polluted, running out occasionally to get our wheatgrass or something that then allows us to justify, I'm okay. There's another way of living. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
I'm going to play John Henry here this evening for you all, and I'm going to play why John Henry fell dead. At home on his mother's knee, crying that big in a tunnel on that YMV. Mama's gonna be the death of me.
More to come from the music I grew up with, rhythm and blues. Then the hillbilly music as well, lots of banjo. For those of you who called in on Martin Luther King's birthday, the legacy program we did, 3 hours on our sister station, WBAI, to raise money for the station. First of all, thank you for doing that. You probably found that you couldn't make a pledge because the person who really makes sure this station runs, Andrea Katz, was out sick. And hopefully she'll be back tomorrow. And at 5 o'clock, found out that there were no calls and there was no message that says you couldn't make a pledge. In the evening, we raised, I believe it was $9,000, which is a huge amount. And it would have been, just extrapolate that, it had been probably $30,000 had people been able to call and make their pledge. But the station hadn't paid his phone bill. As a result, they turned off the phone. That's what I was told by Andrea Katz, and which is unfortunate, but it got paid, and that's why in the evening people were able to make a call. So let's do the right thing. If you called and were not able to get in, please call the station's number, at which you all should have memorized now. It's a monikered right onto our consciousness, and make your pledge to support the station. The station needs that money. And hopefully going forward, we won't have another debacle like that. But we had it, and it happens, and so a lot of people, I'm sure, were frustrated. But no frustration today. Just call the station, please, and say, I want the two-hour CD set on We Know Who Killed Martin Luther King. Also, to help the station, I have asked Mr. Pepper, one of America's greatest attorneys for civil rights. He was a friend of Martin Luther King and worked for Robert F. Kennedy. He is going to be holding a press conference on WBAI, which will help allow the station to become relevant again, because it will be a historic press conference. I cannot tell you what will be shared. All I can tell you is that all the participants will be hidden out of harm's way until that day. And then through people I know, my contacts within law enforcement, others, will be safely put into a position where you can hear what they have to say. And I can tell you that almost everything you thought you knew or believed about Martin Luther King's assassination is wrong. The truth will come out. And we're very concerned about the safety of Mr. Pepper, but we are working to see that he doesn't end up having an accidental, any accident. And so we will do a two-hour press conference to the world on April 4th. You will hear information that will shake everything off the shelves. This will be a category 6 and its impact upon what you thought you knew about Martin Luther King. More than that, I cannot say, but I can assure you that those who will attempt to disrupt this, those who may feel so threatened that they would think of doing something foolish, this has been anticipated, and protective actions have now been put in place. That's all I'll say on that. So we are going to make the station relevant again in its news capacity to create original, important commentary. Now, also, the station is hurting. And this morning, Andrea Katz and I had a conversation. By the way, she does have a holistic protocol now, and hopefully everything that she needs to get back to work by tomorrow, she'll have. She said, could we pick up the pace because the station literally has no money and needs to pay some bills? And I said, yes. So I agreed, at her suggestion, to do a retreat 1 week and limited in number, because I have to fly in from, in that point, Europe, to do this. But I have, I said yes, and I've called together the friends I know, the top professionals in their field, to come from around the United States to help. This is a fundraiser for WBAI. It is our hope that BAI will make tens of thousands of dollars from it. And here's what you do. You make a call. You get to come. It's $2,500 total, and that's way cheap. And I won't go into all the reasons why. Let's just say that there's a lot of people who care enough to donate and contribute a lot of time that if you had to pay for that, you'd be paying a lot more. But you're getting a week to help change your life. And one person's already coming for free, or whatever they contributed to the station, at $10 or $100, I don't know what it was. They got their name was selected, and they're coming for free, including the airfare, which is terrific. And it'll be April 17th. It'll be in the mountains of East Texas. It's magnificent there. You wouldn't even know you're in Texas because it's not the same terrain. Beautiful lakes and tall trees, organic food and juicing and lectures and workshops and counseling and yoga, meditation. You're going to get it all. I'm going to be there the entire time. And I'm inviting one person from management to come so they can actually see what goes on. Why this is not just a vacation, or it's not like a spa. This is a life-transforming experience. Now, I'm going to play you a brief clip of a recent group of people who attended a retreat. You haven't heard this before. This is brand new. It only takes a few minutes.
My name is Dee Willis. I just spent a week at Gary's retreat. It was wonderful. I've had, it sounds very cliche, but a life-changing experience. I recently lost this year 56 pounds, and now I've found the protocol, you know, to keep the weight off. You know, I feel more energetic. I feel more empowered. My body, I walk 9 miles the last few days. It's my body feels, it has a lot of endurance, and I'm looking forward to having an empowered year. I have much more energy. I thought I had energy before, but I have a lot of energy. My thinking of being out here in this tropical paradise has caused me to have more focus. I can sleep. I dream. I remember my dreams. I haven't remembered my dreams in a long time, but I've actually remembered my dreams.
Hello, my name is Brian. In the past week, the changes I've experienced. When I first came here, we were running around the track. I was doing 12 laps around the track. And today, on the next to the last day of a week, I did 64 laps, and I feel great. I feel just, overall, the most important thing is I feel more at peace with myself. The amount of change I've had here, and I know from evidence from my past, has been greater than 10 years of training or therapy that I've gotten in this past week.
My name is Rebecca from Ghana, West Africa. I was in this retreat this week, and before I got here, I was so sick, I almost canceled this flight. But, you know, I have some kind of faith or something, you know, the way I was hearing people giving testimony on the radio, I said, no, let me go, because when I go, I know I'm going to get better. Before, I thought I was doing everything good. But when I got here, things are different. It's like I have gained my strength. I have extraordinary energy that I don't know where it came from. It's so fantastic. There's no amount of money that can pay for this trip. It's so wonderful. And I'm so grateful I got this.
Those are just some of the people, and not the most remarkable. Those are still to come, including one person who is in hospice and on his way out of life. And his changes were simply unbelievable in 1 week. Now, I don't make anyone promises that what's going to happen. All I can say is that everything that we can do to encourage positive thinking, positive thoughts, positive actions, you're going to receive. And it's as good as it gets. I know of no other place on the planet you can go and have all that coming at you. And most importantly, it will help the station get through an extraordinarily important and critical time. And that's what we need to do to save our station. And I'm here, as I always have been, to help the station. That's the whole purpose of the effort, help the station. And I know many people in this audience know that I've always been here to help the station. In fact, I've raised the station in just the last couple of months with premieres of a film, a lecture I did at the New School, because Andrea Katz is on the I believe the faculty there, or knows someone on the faculty. And it was a beautiful venue, but every seat was taken. People were standing and sitting in the aisles. But that netted over $23,000 plus. And the other one netted $14,000. And then, so we are looking forward to hopefully earning this. Our goal is to earn the station about $30,000 to $40,000 net. And what's good is the station doesn't have to worry about not sending a premium, because when you come, you get the premium. I've raised in the 40 years, BAI and Pacifica stations, over $47 million. That's how much I believe in the station, its mission, and its audience, irrespective of all the differences in how things have gone on over the years and the different leaders and the different programmers. At the end of the day, what is important is the audience. So this is one way we can help the people in this audience start the new year with health and happiness, and address the questions you need addressed. And you'll get personal counseling also. So it's just one great adventure, from the taste of the gourmet vegan food, all my recipes presented beautifully, cooking classes, growing classes, sprouting classes, hydroponic classes, yoga, meditation, art as healing. You're going to get it all. So here it is. Give a call. 631-504-6198. 631-504-6198. Help WBAI. Help yourself. And I'll save for another time the most phenomenal testimonials that you've ever heard, from people who just came and went home altogether transformed. 631-504-6198. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Null, on the road filming an important series of documentaries. From Fort Hunt, Virginia, Mike Lofgren. And I gave Mike's background a little earlier. Nice to have you with us today, Mike.
Good to be here.
Mike, you left government early because you were disgusted with the Democratic Party turning into an incompetent and irrelevant faction, and the Republicans transforming into what you called the apocalyptic cult that was fundamentally anti-intellectual and anti-science. And in both parties, you witnessed the evolution of each becoming servants to private interest and money. So over 30 years ago, when you first entered government service, nobody would have called our government an oligarchy. There remained a functioning democracy. American citizens still participated in a notable manner. Today, it is hard to stretch our imagination to call the U.S. a functioning democracy. A joint study by Princeton University and Northwestern University has concluded that the U.S. today is categorically an oligarchy. Therefore, there has been a gradual transformation over the years. The government has evolved, or de-evolved, from a democratic model to an oligarchical state that operates now as a shadow government. And you witnessed during your career this transformation. So with historical insight, please note the most salient events or trends you witnessed in Washington that has contributed to the creation of a rule by deep state or shadow government.
Well, as you, I think, correctly characterized, my first book, The Party is Over, looked at the party system in America and concluded that it was bankrupt for the reasons you mentioned. The Democrats were kind of a conflicted party, pretending to be the party of the people, but dependent on big corporate donors. And the Republicans were becoming a cult of right-wing authoritarians. We can see that in the Republican presidential campaign now. But later, I thought, although this analysis was correct, it didn't go far enough, because whatever the symptoms of the two parties, there's a kind of internal political GPS that keeps the country going in the same direction, following more or less the same policies, with a few nuances. With respect to the big money issues, such as overseas militarism and all the contracts that spins off for the military-industrial complex, Wall Street power, and the surveillance state. And this happens regardless of which party is in power, and regardless of squabbles. I'm not saying they're unimportant. They can be important. And there are real policy differences between the parties over, say, gay marriage or abortion. But those aren't the central money issues that the oligarchy, the people who run the country, are really interested in. You quoted the Gillen's Page study, the two professors from Princeton and Northwestern. Here's what Martin Gillen's actually said. This is a direct quote. The preferences of economic elites have far more independent impact upon policy change than the preferences of average voters. I'd say that contrary to what political science research might lead you to believe, ordinary citizens have virtually no influence over what their government does in the United States. And economic elites and interest groups have substantial influence. Government policy making over the last few decades reflects the preferences of those groups. So that's basically my thesis, why the warfare state that we have, of kind of an endless war on terrorism, it's cost us, by the way, $4 trillion since 9/11, and the kind of Wall Street casino economy that we have are not unrelated. They flow from the worldview of the same people, the billionaire class that's running this country.
In modern systems theory, there's a model used to understand the dysfunctions of human institutions that is called the iceberg model. It means that we tend to focus solely upon what is above the surface without realizing the greater ice mass lying in the darkness beneath the surface where the real problems of dysfunction lie. And above the surface, what is in plain view, politicians asking the wrong questions for why there are problems and how to fix them. I feel this is an accurate description of our political system today, and politicians from both parties fail to ask the right questions. Therefore, they conjure the wrong answers, and I believe this is intentional. It keeps the pageantry and the illusion of a faux democracy in the spotlight, and this, furthermore, seduces the population into believing this is a country that stands for liberty and freedom and intolerance. Yet beneath the surface, in the massive ice chunk of money, corruption, lobbying, and payoffs, and super PACs, and Wall Street, the private military-industrial complex, a bought-off private mainstream media, and so much more, the real governance of an elite and the causes of dysfunction are, that's where you're finding it. And is this an accurate analogy and or inaccurate from your experience? You were there. And how would you better visualize this to our audience?
Well, I mean, there's a lot of ways of visualizing it and a lot of metaphors. 90 years ago or so, Sinclair Lewis said, it is difficult to get a man to understand something when he's being paid not to understand it. And that includes so many people in the media, in government, in the Washington think tanks. They're being paid not to understand the problem. What you talked about with the iceberg, you know, 100 years ago or more, the German sociologist Max Weber called it the iron cage, that bureaucracies create structures. And by bureaucracies, I don't mean just the government. Corporations create them. All kinds of institutions create bureaucracies. They develop structures that sort of force the people who act within them to conform to whatever their peers, and particularly their superiors, are thinking. The psychologist Irving L. Janis wrote a book about this. He called it groupthink. That, and this is something I noticed quite a bit on Capitol Hill. In the period between 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq, when we had this drumbeat of weapons of mass destruction, that Saddam was allied with Al-Qaeda and so forth, if you looked objectively at the evidence, it just wasn't there. But people were essentially being marched to the edge of a precipice by a sort of bandwagon effect and a lot of rah-rah in the media. I know that NBC, for instance, fired Phil Donahue and Ashley Banfield because they had the temerity to be critical of the rush to war. The fact that NBC at the time was owned by General Electric, which gets a lot of money from military contracts, you can draw the conclusion yourself.
You're absolutely correct. I appreciate that. Thank you. A question that has bothered me concerns why we don't see more insiders such as yourself going public as whistleblowers and bringing to public attention the degree of corruption and fraud in our political system. And unless a politician gets caught red-handed in some sort of tax scheme or business or sex scandal, we don't hear about our politicians' non-democratic and subversive activities except in the alternative independent media. If our government is so corrupt, then why aren't we seeing more government employees coming forward as whistleblowers? Because you got millions of government employees. And then who or what controls government employees to keep them aligned in the deep state?
Well, for one thing, the media, the commercial media, there were probably anywhere between 60 and 80 major media companies 35 years ago that controlled the vast majority of commercial media. Now it's narrowed down to about 5 or 6. So that's one thing. It's essentially a kind of oligopoly. Second, stories of following the money, what your tax money is being used for, what we're doing in other countries as opposed to what Pentagon and State Department spokesmen say we're doing, those are complicated stories. They require a lot of gumshoe journalism, and they don't sell cornflakes. That's why they would rather have the public fixated on whether Tom Brady deflated a football or what Kim Kardashian is doing or this sort of thing. So there's a kind of dumbing down or deliberate dumbing down of the populace by the media. The other thing is people in the iron cage or people engaging in groupthink, most of them tend to go along with it and assimilate those ideas. Now, the ones who don't, particularly at the lower level, who become whistleblowers, well, there's quite substantial punishment for whistleblowers. The Obama administration, which came into office touting itself as progressive, has the so-called insider threat program to punish whistleblowers, to profile people whom they imagine are malcontents, and sort of proactively look at them. So this kind of atmosphere does not exactly portend transparency in government.
Do you see any indication that this emergence of a powerful shadow government is leading the U.S. towards becoming a full-blown totalitarian or fascist state?
Well, what we have now is kind of a semi-oligarchy with semi-features of democratic process. The problem is both parties, no matter who you vote for, you tend to get the same policies on foreign policy and financial regulation and so forth, with a few optical nuances. It has been, I think, since 9/11, been going down a road where one does have to worry about what we can maintain. Now, the Republican Party has had, you know, ever since Lee Atwater and even before that, Nixon's Southern strategy, it's used dog whistles and coded language to appeal to a kind of authoritarian mind and xenophobic mindset. I think, however, that since 9/11, we're finally feeling the full effects of that, insofar as this attempt by the government to make people fearful of terrorism. And, you know, ISIS is a bunch of criminals, but they're in no way an existential threat to the continued existence of the world the way it would have been if we'd had a nuclear exchange with the Soviet Union. So they are deliberately overblowing the threat, and I think it has had an effect on people. They are now so fearful that they are dropping the code words. Trump and probably Cruz are dropping the code words. They're giving the straight, you know, appeal, which is quasi-fascist, I would submit.
I appreciate, Mike, your work, The Deep State, The Fall of the Constitution and the Rise of a Shadow Government. And the website is Mike, Lofgren, mikeandgary.com. Mike, thank you for being with us today.
Enjoyed being here.
I'm Gary Knoll. That brings up the end of another program. I thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more with you on tomorrow's program. Have a nice day, everyone.